Against a 39-year-old woman from Silver Lakes in the east of Pretoria have nearly doubled since her arrest in November 2019. She faces 18 charges of statutory rape, sexual grooming, and use of a minor to produce child pornography in the Pretoria Regional Court. This package has been compiled by our senior reporter, Leila Magnus.
During June to October 2019, the women allegedly started grooming the boys by talking to them via social media. Sexual grooming relates to a process whereby a person builds a relationship with victims so that he or she can manipulate and exploit them sexually. The conversations allegedly led to naked photos being shared between the parties. The state alleged the woman sent nude pictures of herself as well as videos of herself masturbating to the boys and requested they send pictures of their genitals back. She, however, allegedly only asked the 14-year-old boys for pictures and not the 17-year-old boy. She is accused of touching the penis of two of the 14-year-old boys, kissing them inappropriately and performing oral sex on one, which all culminates in the statutory rape charges. Some of the boys were learners at the prestigious Afrikaanswoer Seunskool in Pretoria at the time of the incident. The fact that the case was reported and made it to court is very unusual, says forensic social worker at the University of North West, Sufran Smith.
It does happen that a male can be the victim of sexual abuse, but it's not as often reported as female sexual abuse. And that's mainly because of the stigma that's attached to it by society's perception. So when a boy, and especially when a teenage boy, is abused by a woman, remarks are made such as, "What are you complaining about?" So there's that perception that sexual contact by women should also always be welcomed. And if you do not welcome it, the question is of but what's wrong with you?
She says the victims struggle afterwards with extreme feelings of guilt.
It creates intense guilt for those children, and often they feel guilty and they say, but I've enjoyed it because I had an orgasm or I had an erection. But that was their body only reacted in the way it was intended to react, but it creates intense feelings of guilt at the end.
Smith says the damage done to children who are sexually abused lasts very long.
Usually victims of sexual abuse, and this can be now male or female, they suffer from depression and anxiety. Often they have eating disorders or they start to use drugs and things like that. Often they suicide attempts. And in future relationships, they often have difficulty to be intimate with a partner, to be emotionally intimate with a partner, to be sexually intimate with a partner. And they often cannot have a trusting relationship with their partner. And they are often very suspicious of other people's intentions and behavior.
The woman will appear in court again in December when a psychologist and social worker's forensic clinical assessments are expected to be finalized. I am Leila Magnus in Pretoria.
And we now speak to Lisa Vetten, Research Associate at Wits University's Institute for Social Economic Research and also Research Project Consultant at the University of Johannesburg. Lisa, good afternoon. Welcome to the show. Thank you so much for making time for us. When I heard the story first on air this afternoon, I thought of there must be an issue around the underreporting of such incidents of where young boys become victims of sexual abuse and the perpetrator or the alleged perpetrator being a woman because of the stigma attached to it.
Yes, and I think the stigma runs both ways. I think because sexual violence that girls and women experience is so overwhelming in number, that's who we typically think of as victims. And what that means is that we don't really leave space in our public conversations for boys to think of themselves as having been victimized in some way. I think what we also do is that if somebody is victimized by a woman, because that is so unusual, the stigma may be doubly great because this is so unusual and so different. And I think for a woman who is accused of perpetrating this, it can also become quite difficult in that people look at her as being profoundly abnormal because we expect this behavior from women, or from men rather than from women. And so we don't necessarily behave in the most informed manner either when it comes to female perpetrators.
Mm-hmm. And is there a way also of how that societal norm also has an impact on how you respond to it? For instance, if the boy was to come and say that I have been touched inappropriately, or I have been forced to go into sexual penetration with this particular woman because, again, of the issue around the stigma.
I mean, I think, and one of your guests in your previous package mentioned this, is I think we have such different ideas. Our ideas about sexuality are so gendered that there is very much a perception, you know, that boys are sexually active earlier than girls, are much more sexually active as well. And therefore, when something like this happens, it's something, A, to be proud of, because an older woman has taken an interest in you. How nice. And also, you know, could it really have been that disturbing? Weren't you really lucky? So I think that also makes it very difficult for boys to speak. The numbers are small. I think we have data from 2012 which suggested that 1% of rapes that were reported, and it's only reported, in 2012, 1% were perpetrated by women, and 5% of those who reported were boys as being victims. So I think there's quite clearly a lot more work that needs to be done in order to create the kind of language that would become available for boys to speak about what has happened to them.
Yeah, and where do we start with those type of conversations? And also to normalize, even, or rather, let me not say normalize, but creating an environment and a space that is conducive for a boy child to come forward about sexual abuse.
I think we have to look at the language of vulnerability. It's profoundly gendered, and by that I mean that we use the terms vulnerability over and over again in relation to women and girls. And I think that makes it very hard for boys to be recognized as victims. I think, especially in our construction of masculinity, is so often around things like violence and abuse. You typically think of them as perpetrators rather than as victims. So I think it's also shifting the very gendered ways in which we are thinking about that language in order to be able to make it possible for boys. And I think also there is this assumption about, I spoke about, in terms of how we think about sexuality.
Mm-hmm.
Important to be able to start thinking about about how do we reimagine boy sexuality so they can speak about vulnerability without people laughing at them or thinking that they're less than masculine or that they must have had a great time and what's wrong with them. So it is important, I think, that we have those sort of conversations at schools, but it's also, I think, looking at our policy language. It doesn't really right now, I think, give the space to recognize boys' vulnerability.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, I'm going to touch on that just after this. But just quickly on the issue around where exactly is it where we find incidents of this nature being prevalent?
Well, I think you'll typically find them in spaces where women do have positions of some kind of authority or power over boys. So I think the examples that we have seen in South Africa, for instance, have often been female teachers. The example, I think, was from Bishops, a boys' school in the Western Cape a couple of years back. There we had an example of a female teacher with her male students. And I think, obviously, in situations where you are a family friend, that kind of gives you the access and opportunity. Because I think the model of the woman who goes out at night with her knife and grabs young boys and rapes them doesn't really exist. It's within intimate situations, like family scenarios, where you know the person, or in school environments where you have that kind of authority because you are a teacher.
So
that's where we find it most likely to happen.
Yeah. And speaking then about the issues in relation to policy and also the understanding of society of rape itself, and of course you spoke about the norm would be, or what we are used to, is that it is the males being the perpetrators. And some people even having a debate around whether it is possible for a boy to be raped if that person was aroused. So the perception is almost as if the boy must have wanted to do this, even though there is the element around the statutory rape to it.
Yes, exactly. And I mean, I think we also have to, and one of your previous speakers was alluding to this, we can't overlook the effect of biology. I mean, I think arousal can be very involuntary. One can't assume it's always under somebody's control, and I think especially when boys are young. The fact that you may become involuntarily aroused doesn't necessarily mean that that emotionally that is what you want to do. It is, I think, the one thing that people struggle with is the fact they feel that their bodies betray them if there is an arousal. So I think that's something we have to sort through. But if I can flip it a little bit and go back to some of the policy,
yeah.
I think it means also looking a little bit more at the language that we use in relation to female sexuality and its agency.
Sorry, Lisa, we're losing you there a bit.
Okay, so if you go back at the Sexual Offences Act, and you can see how impossible it is almost for people to think of women as being active in sexuality, the language it uses is that of penetration. So, I mean, women do not penetrate. If you use that language of penetration, you're thinking implicitly about male as sexual, sexually active, and female as passive and receptive. And if you were thinking in ways that were really gender transformative, we might say be thinking in terms of language like enclosure, for instance, which would recognize that women are the active partners in sex, for instance. So even the language in the act is not able to quite get its head around the fact that sex isn't just a matter of penetration. There are other ways in which it occurs.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, that's the level at which we almost have to start unthinking how we approach the gendered nature of sexuality.
Yeah. Lisa, I just quickly want you to touch on the role of social media in it as well, and perhaps what social media tech companies could be doing. And after that, we'll be going actually to the testimony of Facebook whistleblower, which is currently underway at Capitol Hill. What do you think social media companies should be doing to protect children?
That's an interesting question. You know, I think a lot of this might also be about parents and talking to children about not trusting everybody that you see on Facebook, telling you, you know, about the dangers sometimes of people making friends and what they're doing. I mean, I think it's a very hard thing to answer, and I'm afraid I don't really have great solutions off the top of my head beyond, I think, getting adults to talk to children about if you meet people on Facebook, what are the kinds of questions you should be asking them, what is and isn't permissible. And also, I think we have to catch up with the reality that a lot of sexual introductions are happening via social media.
Yeah.
So how do we rethink exactly those questions about talking to children, explain to them if somebody approaches you, this is what you should try and find out first before just going ahead and saying X, Y, and Z. And I think explaining to children very clearly the consequences of sending nude photos of yourself, who might be looking at them and whose hands they could fall into, and what that might mean for you.
Thank you so much for your time, Lisa Vetten, the research project consultant at the University of Johannesburg. So we are going to go to Capitol Hill now, where Facebook whistleblower is testifying before the U.S. Congress. The data scientist Francis Hogan says that the company was aware of harm to some teens from Instagram and has also been dishonest about its fight against hate and misinformation.
They rely on AI so much. It is very possible that none of those ads were seen.